So when we listen to Dharma teachings, the first thing we need to do is we need to generate the precious attitude of bodhicitta. Can you all hear me? Or am I speaking too soft? Okay, I'll speak up. So the first thing we need to do is we need to develop the precious attitude of bodhicitta. And so now think to yourselves that it is for the benefit of all sentient beings. And all sentient beings have been our mothers in past lives. They are like our mothers in many ways. We're all related. We're all interdependent in many ways. And just like ourselves, all of these sentient beings want to be happy and want to be free of suffering. And so we need to bring them to the state of the ultimate happiness. And that ultimate happiness is Buddhahood. So Buddhahood basically just means the state of happiness from which you never regress from that happiness. You never lose that happiness. And there's no experience of any sort of suffering at all. And so we need to bring sentient beings to that state. In order to bring sentient beings to that state, we need to understand, or we need to be able to practice the Dharma. And if we are going to practice the Dharma, we first have to understand the Dharma. And so think to yourself that this is the reason why you are listening to these Dharma teachings tonight and for the next couple days. Of course, you know, as Rinpoche always says, of course you always have a good motivation just to come here, but it's good to remind yourself and to think about it, because as we'll be going about, there are different types of motivation. We'll get to that tomorrow. There's the motivation that, you know, gets you to initially sign up, and then there's the motivation that you actually have at this very moment. So it's important that we try to listen with a pure motivation of bodhicitta to these Dharma teachings. And the Dharma that we're going over is karma, what it is and what it isn't, which is maybe too cute a title. I don't know. It got you all here. And then actually, it's only a little bit of what we're talking about. It's really what we're... because you have to figure out not just what is karma, you have to know what are the different types of karma and how is it that karma works? What is the mechanism by which karma works? And so in putting together this, or sort of thinking about what to talk about, what I'm basing these teachings on is a text called The Treasury of Abhidharma by Vasubandhu. And so this is the handout. These are extracts from it. And so the whole fourth chapter of The Treasury of Abhidharma, all 130 verses of it, is about karma. Some of the verses I left out, though. I didn't give you everything, because you don't need to know all the differences between perceptible and imperceptible forms and the positions of the Darshantika school and things like that. I figured I didn't want to give you anything that was going to spin your head, make your head spin this year. Maybe next year. But there's a lot in there that we need to understand about how it is that karma works, because karma is a pretty vast topic, and it's actually one of the most important teachings of Buddhism. You've all heard of the Four Noble Truths, right? So you've got the first noble truth is what?
Truth of suffering.
Truth of suffering. And then what's the second truth?
Cause of suffering.
The origin. The cause of suffering. Okay, what is the origin of suffering? What are the two aspects of the origin of suffering? Do you know? Karma and the afflictions. Okay. So basically, all of the experiences that we have in this defiled, impure world realm that we are in come out of karma and the afflictions. So as it says at the beginning of the fourth chapter, it says, from karma various worlds are born. So karma is an extremely important topic for us, because if our hope is to, in the short term, decrease, and in the long term, ultimately rid ourselves entirely of suffering, we have to know what does suffering come from, and we have to know how to get rid of it. And so, for that reason, we need to know what both karma and the afflictions are. So in this weekend, we're primarily going to be focusing on karma, but there will be some talk about the afflictions at the end, just so that you get at least an overview of the whole truth of origin. And so then when you've eliminated the cause of suffering, well, what do you get? What's the third noble truth?
Cessation.
What does cessation mean? Stopping what?
Suffering.
Yeah. So we're stopping suffering, stopping anything that will cause suffering. And then how do we achieve that? And Peter, don't say. How do we achieve that?
Through the path.
The path. Right. So by practicing the path. So those are the four noble truths. And if we're going to, basically, if we're going to practice Buddhism, we've got to practice these four noble truths. And so in order to do that, we have to actually know what they are. And so we're going to focus on the second of them. Suffering, I think we all know on some level what suffering is. We all have experiences. And I think most of the people in this room, there's something that brought you here tonight. There's some experience you had. Maybe you just came out of curiosity. I won't deny that possibility. But most of us have something that has initially got us involved in practicing Buddhism. And so we all have some sort of experience of suffering. So now we need to know, what did it come from and how does it work? But this is a topic that it's actually very difficult for us in America to come to know anything about, because teachers say, okay, karma is very important, but if you talk about karma, people just aren't going to come back to the Dharma Center, so we're not going to talk about it. Or they say, you know, actually, I was corresponding with another center that's talking about that I'm going to be teaching karma. Everyone on the East Coast wants karma, and so so another center said, karma's great, but don't talk about the hell realms, you know. So people have these ideas about it that it's something that's off-putting, that people don't want to know about, that you can't present in a way that people are going to get, or that they're going to be able to see why it is that we're talking about it. And so what happens for the students is that you get all these books on Buddhism and they sort of gloss over it. And in Western texts on Buddhism, there's a lot of talk about mindfulness, a lot of talk about techniques of meditation, but very little talk about really what's one of the core teachings of Buddhism. You can't open up a sutra without, well, you can't open up a sutra without seeing it. You can read the Heart Sutra. But almost any other sutra, if you read the sutra, there's some talk about previous life, what was the karmic cause of this, what was the karmic result of that. And so karma is really integral to the teachings of Buddhism, to the understanding of Buddhism. And it's really critical to understand it, in part also to understand how it is that through our practice that we can gain results, how it is that if we don't practice, we'll experience results, painful results. And so this is why it is important for us to understand the karma. But, you know, actually American Buddhists are not very good about it, we have a lot of misconceptions about what karma is, because we use the word in our daily lives. And when we use it in our daily lives, we sort of use it as if it's like fate, you know, karma. I can't do anything about it. It's my karma. Which is kind of a funny one. So, you know, we sort of think, oh, karma, you have no control over your karma. You can't do anything about it. And then some people even say, you don't need to know anything about karma. Karma is not necessary to practice Buddhism. There are even people who write books about Buddhism that sell very well who actually say the Buddha did not teach about karma, the Buddha that understanding karma is not necessary, that you do not need to know about rebirth and anything like that in order to practice Buddhism. Now, to be fair to that perspective, in terms of doing meditation practice and gaining limited results, which are a lot of peace and stability in this life, that's very true. And even though I'm saying that's a limited result, it's actually a very significant thing for most people. That's really what gets us, most of us here, you know, in the beginning. We want to improve our situation in this life, but we also need to have a broader perspective on things. So it's important that we understand about karma for these reasons. But we sort of think of karma as being something mysterious. But it's actually not as mysterious as we think it is. You know, basically, when we say the word karma, all we mean are actions. So karma just means action. It's something that you do. And when you do something, that has a result. That's what we mean by karma. And so we can see this in our daily lives. We can see that the things that we do have results. Actually, I was talking with Rinpoche about this before I left Nepal last month, and he brought up the sort of startling idea. If you look at it on a collective sort of way, you can see the results of actions. He used the example of 9/11. So there were a group of fanatics who did a horrible deed that led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan. 3,000 people here, you know, over 100,000 people probably in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly what they were counting up on the news the other day, something like, some people say 80,000 people in Iraq and 70,000 people in Afghanistan. That is a result of the bombers on September 11th. So you do something and it creates an effect. In fact, for Osama bin Laden, who masterminded it, the result of it for him is that he's had to run all over and can't live in the open. And I don't know how he feels about that. Maybe he likes it better or not. But it is a result. It had an effect on him. Rinpoche also brought up a rather surprising example and a rather provocative one, too. He brought up the example of Hitler. You know, Adolf Hitler did these horrible things. And what happened to Hitler in the end? He took his own life. He had such mental anguish and suffering that he had to take his own life and saw no other out for it. So we can see that the actions produce results. I think these are deeds that, these are sort of the extreme examples, the sort of headlines that, you know, the push-button issues, 9/11 and Hitler. But if we look in our own lives, I think we can see that the things that we've done have actually had effects later on in what we've done. And I don't think it's necessary to say any more than that. We all know what we've done, and we all know what it's done to us. That's one aspect, is it, that we actually do see the results of our actions in this life. The other way we can see the results of it is, it's not just our own individual actions, there are also the collective actions. There is collective karma. There is, we all have the collective action of burning a lot of fossil fuels. The result of this is climate change. So we see an action, burning fossil fuels, leading to a result. So you can also see that you're polluting water. Another example that Rinpoche gave was, you pollute water in Tibet, and what happens is you have problems in India and China because of the pollution in Tibet. So our actions as a society, as a community, also have repercussions for us in that respect. So you don't have to necessarily believe in past and future lives to believe that our actions create results. I mean, you basically believe that your actions create results, then what you're saying is you're believing in karma. Essentially, that's what karma is. If you do good actions with good motivations, it brings good results. If you do bad actions, it brings bad results. It's really pretty simple. And so we can see this within our own life. And because we can see that, it really points out the necessity for us to have a really good, you know, we have to have a good heart. We have to understand, you know, we have to have good intentions, a good heart. Otherwise, it doesn't. Otherwise, our actions will correspondingly be bad. So that's sort of thinking about it in terms of this one life. But when we talk about karma in Buddhism, we do also talk about it going from lifetime to lifetime. And this is a problem for a lot of people. A lot of people have problems with the idea of rebirth. And this is understandable because our culture doesn't teach. We don't grow up necessarily thinking that there is rebirth. Most of us probably grew up in either atheist or Judeo-Christian families, where if you believe in future lives, you believe in one afterlife, and that's it. And a lot of us have sort of not found that particularly convincing. And previous lives are difficult for people to understand, and particularly people with scientific perspectives. So when we talk about past and future lives, the first thing that we have to say is that you cannot scientifically prove that they're there, because we cannot perceive them with our naked eye. We can have inferential evidence that can point us to have some sort of confidence in it, but we can't. It's very difficult to say, okay, we can see it, we can measure it in the way that's going to satisfy a scientist. We just can't do it. So we can't prove that they exist. By the same token, we also cannot prove that they don't exist. And since we cannot prove that they don't exist, then, as Rinpoche always says, you know, it's to our advantage to it's to our advantage to think that they do exist. Because if you think they don't exist, and you think, there's no future life, there's no such thing as karmic repercussions in future lives, I can party now. And you party, you live a hard life, and you do, you know, a few bad things along the way, a few good things along the way, a few bad things along the way. Then when it comes to the time of your death, you pass away, and you discover all of a sudden there is a future life. You're standing there before Mr. Lord of Death, and he's saying, you didn't pay attention. Those black beads outweigh the white beads. Actually, it doesn't work like that, actually. That's another of our misconceptions about karma. We think that there's some guy with a beard who's going to say, we think it's like the idea of there's a guy with a beard who's going to say, you did bad, you're going to pay. You know, you did good, you can come to heaven. You know, we have this idea that it's going to be like that, and it really doesn't work that way. This is why it's important for us to understand how it works. But, you know, with the... you know, with rebirth, you know, if you come to the point of your experience, you pass away and you discover that your consciousness is continuing and that you're going towards some sort of an experience and you have no control, no idea of what it's going to be. At that point, it's too late to do anything about it. But right now, while we're in this life, we do have a chance to do something. And so if in this life we say, okay, we're going to take it that karma, that there probably are karmic repercussions in future lives of our actions, and then we lead our lives in good ways, and we act in ways that are virtuous, that is, ways that bring happiness and positive results, then, in the future, at the time of death, if there's no, you know, if there's no future life, okay. But there's actually no problem with that because you've done things that make your own life, this current life, better. So you win out either way. So it's better to act as if there were karma and as if there are future lives, because it helps you in this life, and if there are future lives, it helps you in the future lives. Now, that's usually as far as Rinpoche goes with the rebirth argument. He actually does say one more thing. He always says, and if you study the teachings in the Abhidharma, you can come to some confidence that there is future lives, that there are future lives, that there are past and future lives. So, what are those teachings in the Abhidharma? That's the problem. And that's what we're going to primarily be talking about tonight. Tomorrow we'll get to the actual discussion of karma, depending on how quickly I speak tonight and how many questions it provokes. So, have any of you had any experience to the traditional logics as to why there are future lives? No, no one's ever explained anything to say, this is the reason why we say there. Okay. That's why you're here. I just wanted to check. A part of this is, you know, I'm sort of testing the waters, you know, seeing, is my hypothesis that no one's told you anything true? And it's thus far, it's thus far it seems to be holding. So basically, there are a couple of traditional arguments, and I'll go over them briefly first, and then we'll talk about them in detail. The main argument is that everything arises from a cause, and our minds have a cause. So what is the cause of a cognition, of a moment in the mind? And in Buddhism, we talk about mind being separate from body. They're related to each other, they're linked to each other, but they're fundamentally, in their essence, in their substance, they're separate. The body is physical, and the mind is clear and knowing. And so the clear and knowing cognition comes out of something. It can't really come out of physical. It can be influenced by physical things, but it has to come out of something that's like it. So it comes out of the previous instant of cognition. So, like, you can think about this. You think, if we think about it on a level, you have a eye consciousness that sees a cup of hot cider. And then you think to yourself, that looks good. You know, so that's another thought. You've got the eye consciousness, which then provokes the that looks good thought, right? And so then that's how that happens. Well, each of these consciousnesses comes from the previous consciousness, the main cause, the substantial causes of each consciousness. And so you can go back from one consciousness to the previous consciousness all the way back to the moment of birth or the moment of conception. And so at the moment of conception or sometime in the embryonic stages, could cognition just have arisen out of material sources? And that's pretty much what scientists say, but in Buddhism we say no, because they're fundamentally different in substance. And so the cognition has to have come out of a previous moment of condition all the way back. And so when you get to the cognition at the moment of conception, there had to be a cognition before that, which is the cognition in the between state, the bardo or between state, between the moment of death and the next rebirth, all the way back. And so in this way, we say that there is a sequence of cognitions leading all the way back. You can't find the first one, because each one has a cause, because there's nothing that arises without a cause. Is that clear? Okay, so that's the traditional argument that basically says there have to have been previous lives because of that infinite chain. And unless you interrupt the sequence of causes and conditions, there will be future lives as well, because that sequence of causes and conditions just replicates itself until you do something to cause its cessation. And then the other traditional argument is that when a sheep is born, it knows how to walk right away. How could it have known how to walk if it didn't have imprints from previous life? Right? Mm-hmm. It's what we call instinct, in other words, you know. Mm-hmm. Instinct is like imprints from previous lives. You've learned how to do something. The sheep has learned how to spring about and suck from its mother's teat in a previous life. And so it pops out again, and it's got that imprint, and pops up, and it... mother licks it a few times, and then it, you know, finds the mother's udder pretty quick. And so that's how we know, because no one could have taught that sheep anything. So it had to have come out of something from previous lives. So are those clear? Mm-hmm. Those are the two main traditional examples. But we can also think of the examples of great beings like the Gyalon Karmapa, Trungpa Rinpoche, and so forth. Because if they take rebirth, and they can, you know, remember things from previous lives, we can be certain that they're the same being from one life to another, then if they're going from one lifetime to the next, then we're probably also going from one lifetime to another. That's another way to think about it. So these are those are the general things we can think about. And I think the big sticker for most Westerners, people with scientific educations in thinking about this, is the first initial assumption that we're making in Buddhism, which is that the mind and the body are separate, and that the mind does not arise out of physical conditions. Actually, we say the physical arises out of the mind, in a way. So we put it backwards. And scientists, they say you've got, the scientific is you had, the explanation is you had the Big Bang, then you had this long period, and then the earth formed, and then there was a primordial soup, and some lightning happened, and some algae grew, and then then there formed organisms which somehow miraculously developed consciousness, and they developed through evolution into humans. And all of it, basically, we talk about our consciousness. If you look at most of the popular literature on in scientific publications, they talk about consciousness as essentially being little different than the electricity that goes about in our brain. And you manipulate the brain, you shock it in some way, it causes it, or if you, you know, if you have all the famous experiments about people who lose function of some part of the brain and that changes their personality or changes their brain function in some way. And so scientists use this as proof that anger comes out of activity in a certain part of the brain. Therefore, anger is a manifestation of the brain. So that's, I mean, in a nutshell, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm probably not doing that argument full justice. But in Buddhism, we take a different approach. We basically say that with the mind and the body are related. There's no doubt about that. The mind and that there are connections between the two, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that the mind and the body are the same. Well, how do we know that they aren't the same? And how can we have proof that will hold up for scientists that they aren't the same? And for me, what thinking about this, it comes down to the issue of if the mind and the body are the same, or if the mind arises out of the electrical activity in the brain or something like that, then the mind would also be limited by the physical constraints of the body, right? So, for example, if there is no brain function, then there should also be no cognition, right? If the cognition arises out of electrical energy in the brain, when there's no electrical energy in the brain, then how can there be any cognition, right? And the other factor is if the cognition arises because of the brain and the physical matter of the body, then there would be no way that the body would be able to actually have any reliable cognition, any reliable direct cognition of anything that's outside of the physical sphere of the body. And so for me, these two areas don't hold up. And so the first one, actually, I think, has gotten to be pretty popular in the West. If you read books like James Moody's Life After Life or other books, you know, you talk about near-death experiences and all these things. Now, when you talk about a near-death experience, that's someone who's come near to death and hasn't actually died yet. So it's not an actual complete description of death. But what a lot of these descriptions of near-death experience feature is an out-of-the-body experience. And there are also stories of people who die on the operating table. And the physicians are monitoring them. No heart activity, no brain activity. They're dead. And then they manage to resuscitate them. And there are stories of people who then tell the physicians everything that the physicians did while they were brain dead. So if they are brain dead at that time, then they were brain dead at the time, so there was no electrical activity in the brain, yet there was cognition. So we can see that cognition cannot come out of the electrical energy in the brain. Does that make sense, right? Pretty simple. You don't see why they don't get it. And the other one The other experience, this is actually a more personal experience for me. When I first went to Nepal in 2002, my grandmother was nearing the end of her life. And I knew when I left that she wasn't going to last much longer. But I went anyways because I figured I had to say goodbye at some point. And I went to Nepal and was there for 3 or 4 months when one day I left class, walking to lunch, looking at the lovely pine trees and all this, and then all of a sudden I thought, what would happen if my grandmother died? This is a strange thought. Where would this come from? I sort of put it out of my mind, and I went and I had lunch. The next day was a day off, and I went down to Kathmandu, and I opened up my email. Grandma had died. So I call home. And when I called home, what time did Grandma die? Well, she died at 2:10 in the morning, which was 12:05 when I was walking to lunch on that at the same time. So I had the thought, what would I do if Grandma died? Actually, I have to be completely honest, it was not a very good thought at all. What would I do with the inheritance? My sister was only 100 miles away. She was in Montpelier, and my grandmother died in Keene. She woke up at 2:10 on the same night. So, if it had just been me, I would have thought, you know, can't be. But my sister also woke up. So, maybe you could say that, you know, she had some warning because she probably got phone calls, grandma's on her deathbed. But for both of us to have that experience at that same time says to me that the connection between my grandmother and me was a connection that it was not limited by space and time. It's a connection of love. And so our connections of love are very strong. And I think we're all aware of this actually on some level. And it has even made it into Hollywood. How many of you, you've probably all seen The Perfect Storm. I watched it with Lobsang Dorje, who fast-forwarded through all of the dialogue scenes because he didn't understand them. And then there's the last scene, the ship capsizes, and the fisherman, you know, goes up, takes his last breath, and he plunges back down in the ocean, drowns. And they cut to his girlfriend who wakes up in a start in bed, which is the same thing that happened to me with Grandma. So it's the same. It's part of Hollywood, which makes me think that my experience is not special. It's not any unusual experience. If Hollywood is making depictions of it, it's got to be part of the popular culture somehow, which means that other people feel it, right? And maybe you all have had experiences like this too. But these are the reasons that make me think that you look at the medical literature about out-of-body experiences, you look at, and I look at my own experience of this, and it's, I have to say, mind is not physical. That's pretty convincing for me. And then when you think about mind not being physical, then what does it come out of? That's where the traditional logic really works for me. And so that's the line of contemplating that I've used to come to I'm pretty certain, pretty convinced about past and future lives for myself. And then also, if you think about it, we're all so fortunate here to be in this position, you know? And how did we get here? Was it just plain old coincidence? We could have been born in Somalia. We could have been born in anywhere. And so why is it that we were born in an affluent society where we can be fed, clothed, and where we can come into contact with this Dharma that is so helpful and how precious that is? So that comes out of our past and future lives, or past lives as well. So that's sort of the proof for me. I don't know how you all feel about it, but we'll get to that. Or maybe should we take a few minutes for questions now and then go on? Would you like to do that? Let's take 5-10 minutes for questions now, and then we'll go on to the actual mechanics of how it is that we get reborn. Unless no one has any questions.
Well, I'd just like to say something. And not all scientists disagree. And in other words, if we look at an electron as a wave, it becomes a particle. We create matter out of waves. And the universe was created from nothing. And there's the Ion Society and the many other societies that are developing today that actually believe that we create our world.
Yes.
With thought.
Absolutely.
So it's not a universal disagreement.
You're absolutely right on that, and I was using it in a very general term. Yeah, it's and there are, in fact, the person I mentioned, James Moody, is a trained medical doctor, scientific background, and there are a lot of other medical practitioners and scientists who do believe it. There are also scientists who have worked on past and future lives who do it. But if you open up Scientific America, like they're Scientific American, and they have an article about psychology, the dominant view seems to be that the mind comes out of, is a manifestation of the brain. Yes?
I've always wondered, why is it that each time we're born, we have to start over and peel away to get to the true nature of mind? Why is that not, it is pure as it moves through, why is it not in your brain?
Well, the basic answer to this is that we haven't really peeled very far in previous lives, if at all. So the basic answer is that most of us have not done enough meditation practice in prior lives to really have stable realization of the nature of mind. Otherwise, we'd be teaching Dharma ourselves, you know. Otherwise, we'd be the great masters, you know. That's what the great masters have done. And if you look at it, what obscures us from being able to meditate. In the first place, like not being in a physical or mental condition to be able to meditate, or what obscures us from seeing it. From when we do meditate, what prevents us from really being able to have effective meditation is the disturbances in our mind, and that's caused by karma. And so because we haven't really cleansed ourselves in the past, we have to start at the beginning in that sense, in that way. That's why... Yes?
I don't know if I can say this so it makes sense because it's not really formalized, but something just hit me. When you were talking about the second argument that instinct may be an argument for karma, but then in the first argument you were saying that a moment of cognition comes from a previous moment and it has to come from a moment like itself, so it comes from a previous moment of cognition and you go back and back and back. Reborn, and then that has to come from another life. So if that were the case, then wouldn't you have to say then that information is passed with the moment of cognition? But that's not really true. Is it because cognition is possibility?
Think of an analogy. You've got a stream that's flowing down. It's sort of the stream of your continuum. If there's silt in that stream, it's going to get carried downstream. So those silt is like the imprints that go from moment to moment to moment down the course of the river. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, we have the consciousness, which carries all, you know, the continuum of consciousness that goes from one moment to the next to the next to the next. But each moment is sort of created by the previous moment, so all of that baggage that's in the previous moment creates all of the baggage in the next moment. You know what I mean? And so that creates all the baggage in the next moment. So these are all the imprints that we're carrying forward. It's like all the silt that's being carried down in a river from moment to moment to moment. It's like we've got all these imprints or tendencies within ourselves that we're also carrying along in our consciousness.
Okay, as a tendency, I could see it as...
Yeah, it's not... I mean, it's a tendency or an imprint. It's not like saying that... necessarily this is going to happen. It's when the causes and conditions for it to come together happen, then, you know, born as a sheep, pop up and drink mom's milk, you know, the ewe's milk.
Right. Because in a previous life, it could have been a spider. So how would it know how to be a sheep?
If you have an infinite number of lives, it has been a sheep an infinite number of times.
Okay.
It's been human an infinite number of times. It's been sheep, it's been spider, it's been whatever. Yes?
I'm trying to understand how the, to follow your analogy, how the rivers are connected together. Is there like one collective ocean that all these streams of rivers are coming from? And then coming into a life or...
That's a good question.
Rivers, right?
Yeah, we all have separate continua of consciousnesses. We all are separate beings. So we all have our own continuum. My continuum is different from your continuum. It's different from another person's continuum. If they weren't different, then when the Buddha awoke to enlightenment, because we would have also awoken to enlightenment, but we didn't. So... In the relative terms, everything, we have separate continua that go down. And each being has their own separate continua. And so in this way, the actions that we do ripen upon ourselves. But when we all do enough actions that are similar, or we do actions together, then we have what is collective karma that has, you know, sort of a collective result upon ourselves or upon other beings. But it's sort of the result of us doing the same action similarly. Like, for the example of collective karma of the global warming, we're all driving the cars and emitting the CO2s, and we're all feeling the results of that. And that's one level of it. There's also a story about this. One of the lives of the Buddha. There was a group of... I'll see if I remember this correctly. There's this group of city of people that pulled out these, what is it? They were fishing, and they pulled out these two sea monsters, and they beheaded them and then ate them or something like that. It was a city of 80,000 people, and they pulled out these two ministers. Then, as a result of this, the Buddha says, those two ministers were born as the kings of the kingdom of, what was it, Vaishala? And they got influenced by some evil people, and they went and they destroyed all of the 80,000 people who had been reborn as Shakyans. So the 80,000 people killed the two monsters. The two monsters then went back, and in a previous life, they became a king and minister and destroyed all of the other people who had been reborn as the Shakyans. And so that is why, how the Buddha explained the Shakyans all being massacred by the neighboring kingdom. So it's, you know, whether we accept that story as true or not, it's sort of saying we do actions together and we reap the results together, or similar results.
But those results don't affect enlightened beings, then. Is that correct? That the karma doesn't affect...
Karma doesn't affect enlightened beings in their own perception. In the perception of other beings, then it may seem as if they're being affected by karma. But in their own perception, they see the equality of everything, so it's different. Yes. Let's see. You can think, there are doctrinal differences on this one. Let's say for simplicity's sake that until you fully purify them, actually you bring them, each affliction is just a moment of cognition, right? So it comes out of a previous one. So it's not like there's a single... piece of greed that's going through your whole thing. It's like one moment of greed leading to the next, leading to the next. And sometimes it's in a very subtle state, sometimes it's manifest. And so at the moment of taking birth, it's a moment of being afflicted. So there are afflictions at that moment. Probably greed and hatred and delusion. So Let me think about that. We're going to hopefully get to that on Sunday afternoon. Yes?
How does one reconcile the idea of infinite lifetimes with the scientific limited time frame of the universe and the primordial ooze and so forth? If we go back, levels of consciousness spawning the next moment of consciousness, you go back to those times scientifically. That's kind of where I have a problem reconciling rebirth with kind of the scientific. Is there an argument?
I think it's in Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time, there is a point at the beginning where he says, when scientists don't talk about anything before the Big Bang, the reason that they don't talk about it is because they can't say anything for certain about it. So they call it time zero. It doesn't mean that there is nothing before it. So you just can't see past it. And so in that respect, it seems like science actually is taking a very reasonable position. We just can't see past it. And it's actually analogous to Buddhist teachings which talk about the progression of the creation of the universe. You know, at first the universe is created and then it exists without beings for a while and then gradually it's populated by beings by the force of their karma who take rebirth there.
So those beings that were, since there's more beings now than there were, you know, 5,000 years ago, those new consciousness or new human consciousness, were they animals in previous lives? But one could take that back where there's fewer and fewer beings and fewer and fewer people back in time.
There's an infinite number of beings. I mean, we also can't exclude the possibility of other universes. And in Buddhism, we say that there are other universes. We say there were an 8-10 billion-fold world realm. But there are a billion worlds in this world realm, and there are probably other billion-fold. And actually, we say in the sutras that there are other billion-fold world realms. So, other universes, it would seem. At this point, there are more people, there are more beings who have the karma to be born human on this planet. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't have the karma to be born in a human or analogous state in another planet, or as animals or termites. I want to get a little bit further tonight because I want to talk about the mechanics of rebirth. And then we can have some more discussion at the end. Is that? Because you might be wondering, how is it actually that this works? Some of you might have taken Bardo teachings, right? You know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead or Tsedlin Natsat Rangdul's Mirror of Mindfulness and stuff about peaceful and wrathful deities and lights and all this stuff, right? Are you familiar with that? That's the traditional, you know, or the most common presentation. That's the attractive presentation. But I'm going to give you the presentation from the sutras. It's the when we talk about the bardo, sometimes you might think that that's just something that they talk about in Tibetan Buddhism. It's not true. It's something that was talked about in a lot of Indian schools of Buddhism. So there are two different schools of thought, basically. There are those who say that there is a bardo or a between state between lives and those who say there wasn't. So the Theravada school is the major school today that says that there wasn't. And what they say is that moment of death, your karma and your afflictions taken, and the next moment you take rebirth in a new body. But what I'm going to be presenting now is the view presented in the sutras that were preserved by the Vaibhashika, Great Exposition School. And so these are the verses here. It's basically the same presentation as in the tantric, if you remove all the tantric elements like lights and deities and stuff like that. Okay, but basically the core of it is the same. So what happens to us at the moment we die? Basically then, Our bodies and our minds are separated, right? The body becomes a corpse, and the mind goes off to the next, through the next series of things, right? Because the mind causes and conditions moving from moment to moment. And so then the mind enters the bardo state, and the description of the bardo state in the sutras is pretty similar to the description in the tantras, in that it's a very unstable state where a lot of things occur to you. Because you've got the continuum of mind, but it's no longer linked to a physical body. So because it's no longer our physical body sort of anchors us in this life. And then when we lose that anchor, all sorts of things starts happening, and all sorts of appearances occur to us. And so what happens is, as described here on the first verse, on this verse number 15, it says, at some point in the bardo, usually they say 49 days, it says, the mind mistaken out of lust, it goes into its destination. So what happens is, when you have the mind that's, you haven't trained your mind, you have a lot of the afflictions and the negative tendencies, and so you have you perceive something and you feel lust for that, and that makes you go into the destination, like the womb. Like for humans, it's said that when you're taking a human rebirth, then you feel lust for either the father or the mother, and then at the moment that they are engaging in intercourse, then the consciousness enters the womb, and the sperm, the ovum, and the consciousness all join together to make a new being. That's the basically what we call birth, you know, the birth of a being. So you've got this continuum of mind that's going through, and then you feel lust, and then you take birth, either as a human, or you might feel attraction to some sort of place, like as it says here, or others for longing for a smell or a place. So you know, there are beings who aren't, who, you know, like frogs, you know, the father frog and the mother frog's sperm and ova are floating in the pond, and then the consciousness comes in and joins it, right, basically, or insects or something like that. This is what in traditional terms they said was birth from heat and moisture. Heat and moisture, because, you know, they're like they didn't see the cause, you know, they couldn't see the ovum and the sperm, and so they you know, the traditional idea is like, you know, things just sort of spontaneously grow. Well, it's saying that it's out of the lust for the attraction to the heat or the place that then the consciousness enters that. And I think that if you then couple that with a scientific explanation of, you know, the daddy bug and the mommy bug, you know, doing their thing, I think it actually works out pretty well. But then you also have certain rebirths that you would think, why would anyone take rebirth in hell? If we're saying that it is lust or greed that is making us take rebirth, how is it that someone would take rebirth in a hell? So what the teachings say is that, for example, a being might experience, you might experience all these terrible cold and be freezing in the bardo. And then you see this warmth, and you're really attracted by the warmth. Because you're so attracted by the warmth, then you rush towards that warmth and find yourself falling headfirst into hell. So as it says here, they fall headfirst to hell. Or you might find yourself in the bardo being overcome by burning and boiling. You see a cold place, you want to get there, and you end up in one of the cold hells. And so this is the traditional teaching, or the sutra teaching, sutra presentation of how it is that we... The mechanics of how we take birth. And so what this makes me think, what I always think about when I read this is how important it is for us to, like, gain control of our minds now, right? Because if we don't gain control of our minds now, and then there is a bardo, and we get into the bardo, and we discover ourselves feeling lust that we cannot control for some being, and we rush to that place, well, where are we going to end up? We don't know. It could be in a pig. You know, it could be anywhere. It could be human, but if it's human, it might not be a very nice, a very nice state. So this is, if we think about, basically what we're saying is that it's the continuum of our mind. We've got the stream that's flowing with all the stuff in our mind. If we don't purify all that stuff that's going through in our mind, then it's going to take control of us when we are sort of bereft and out of control in the bardo state. So that's basically the mechanism of how we reincarnate and why it's so important to take care of our desires in this life. But the other question that always comes up with reincarnation is, well, what is it that reincarnates if you don't have a if you don't have a self? Like we say, there's no real soul. people always ask this question. And so what it says is no self. There is no self, mere aggregates, continuums of between states. Assembled by afflictions and karma, enter the womb. It's like a lamp. And so basically we just have a continuum. There doesn't have to necessarily be some identifiable soul or identifiable me in order for rebirth to work. It's just like happens in this life. If you think about it in this life, we're just sort of a continuum of the mind and the body, the five aggregates, right? And if you look at us now, we're actually different than we were last year or whenever. You know, when we were first born, we were yay big, right? I had a lopsided head, they say. And maybe it's still lopsided, I don't know. whatever. And you know, now I'm bigger, but I still am bald. So. other people, you know, were bald at birth and now have hair. You know, so obviously different, right? But there's a continuum. So it's just the continuum of the five aggregates, and that continues past death. So at the moment of death, the body and the mind separate, so you leave behind the physical aggregate of form, and then you're left with the mind that continues into the body. And then when it takes birth, it takes another form. And so, you know, it just goes in the cycle. And so just as propelled, the continuum arose in stages, then from karma and afflictions goes to the next world, beginningless wheel of existence. So it's just going over and over and over and over and over again until we do something to stop that cycle. So that's, I think maybe that's enough for me blabbing, and maybe you all have some questions.
I'm sorry, but could you go back to the first line? I'm stuck. The mind mistaken out of lust.
Okay, I didn't explain the mind mistaken. My apologies. So when you say the mind is mistaken, the mind is, it's confused. The mind in the bardo state sees all sorts of terrifying appearances because it's just sort of cut loose from any sort of physical reality. And so there are all sorts of appearances that occur. And it mistakes them. It doesn't realize the true nature of how they are. In the tantric teachings, it talks about how basically we're not realizing these to be the nature of the mind. And so the mind is so basically at that point you're making the fundamental mistake, the fundamental of dualism, thinking that there's something real that you need to run away from, or there's something real that you want to get for yourself. So that's what it means by the mind mistaken. So for example, like with the instance of the beings falling to hell, they see something warm and then they go for something warm and end up in hell. You know.
So basically you carry your afflictions into the bardo state with you.
Pretty much, yeah. It's probably best to think of it that way. All the habits of mind, our minds really work quite a bit by habit. And so if we have habits of the afflictions, then they're actually probably going to be a lot stronger in the bardo state. Conversely, if we have habits of virtue and habits of taking control of our mind now, then we'll have a lot of control in that bardo state. Yes.
So ideally, at the point of death, provided, of course, we don't have a fast death or a quick death, then we actually want to die in a state of meditation.
That would be best, yes.
Mm-hmm. And can, once we die, are we going to have enough control to get ourselves or to maintain that meditation? I mean,
if you practice enough now, yes. But the best teachings for it are the teachings in the Tonglen, the seven points of mind training. Basically, training now in bodhicitta, developing habits of bodhicitta, developing habits of controlling your mind. And when you come to the point of death and doing the Tonglen meditation and following the five practices are the best of methods. They're the best of methods at the time of death. You've got the power of the virtuous seeds, the aspirations to do good things, what are the other powers? I'm not remembering them all off the top of my head, but basically if you look at the teachings and the seven points of mind training, that's the best teaching for us to do. If you have a lot of experience with the Mahamudra and you develop a stable recognition of the nature of your mind, then you can rest in that too. That's also very good. Yes?
Do What do you think about people who die when they're heavily medicated? Three months, and, you know, a lot of them.
The most important thing is to be able to die with a positive state of mind, because the mind, you know, one moment leads to the next. If you have a positive state of mind at the virtuous state of mind at the moment of death, you're much more likely to have a virtuous moment of mind in the bardo, which is going to then do that. So I think if someone is in incredible pain, and that leads them to feel frustration, anger, or whatever, then maybe medication might be better. But if they're able to be lucid and handle it, it's probably an individual thing, and I can't really say. But the most important thing is to try to be in a situation where you can have positive, at least not have a negative mind state. Yes?
In the bardos, the things that you see are things that your mind projects.
Yeah.
And so then, if that's the case, then how do you have lust for where you're going to be born if what you're seeing is all what you're pretending?
Yeah, all your projections, yeah.
Then how do you actually find a true birth somewhere? Because then that is reality versus your mind, right?
Well, that's a good question. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just a... there are two ways you can look at it. You can look at it... as everything is actually just a projection of our minds. All of the appearances that we see around us are not separate from our minds. And everything that we everything that we perceive, you cannot actually prove it has any existence separate from your mind, because you can't prove it exists separate from your perception of it. Otherwise you'd be perceiving it, right? So it's so we can say that actually all of our perceptions are just mind. Now, whether there is actually something out there that causes those perceptions or not is a different matter. But at the moment of that being seeing someone and feeling lust for it, it is a projection of their mind. But your projection, your understanding, your perception of me is a projection of your mind. My perception of you is a projection of my mind. So, you can think of it like we're seeing everything through really strong filters. If you have two people who are looking at the same thing, they're going to see it in different ways. If you, in fact, you can look at the same thing at different times and have totally different perceptions of it. Chocolate cake may look delicious one day. The next day, if you have a real bad stomach virus, it looks revolting. You know, it's the same thing. But your perception of it's different because the filter that you're filtering it through is completely different. So whether you say that it's entirely your own perception or that your perception is a filter that changes how you see it, in either case, what you're perceiving is entirely your own perception. It's nothing. It's not separate from your mind. There are also some neuroscientists who are talking what was that book I read last year? A book that talked about how various artists, the way they, 19th century artists, the way they did their art parallels the way our mind works. Like Cézanne drawing the oranges, drawing a very raw, rough orange there. That, if you think of it, it doesn't look like what we really see as an orange. But it actually is very close to the actual sensory input. We have a sensory input from our eyes, right? And then our brains sort of create this image of whatever it is we're looking based upon that sensory input, according to the neuroscientists. And that's similar to what we're saying. There may be some sensory input or not, but what we're perceiving is a projection. So the projections in the bardo just they're different in that they're less stable than when we have these projections of a physical reality. But they aren't necessarily any more or less our mind. Does that answer your question? Yes, Amy.
Can Rinpoche help us in the bardo? Can function of the guru or meditate on the guru? Or are we're really on our own with our own karma?
When you have devotion to the guru and you meditate on the guru in the bardo, that's yourself helping yourself. But the gurus, and you know, there are methods that you can help beings in the bardo. You can pray for beings in the bardo. You can do that because, you know, it's not, we're separate continua in some sense, but we're all interconnected. And so making positive aspirations, having positive feelings, and making good wishes for someone is going to have some sort of an effect. It's not going to be the main cause, but it is going to have, it can have a really strong effect. And so that's why doing the various, you know, pujas and such, the purification rituals that we do in Tibetan Buddhism, and in general just having good wishes for people in the bardo is so important. You also had a question.
Not using the word
reincarnation. Yeah. Is there,
that's my first question.
Is there
any particular
reason?
Is that just not?
I tend to use reincarnation when talking about lamas who take reincarnation. When you say reincarnation, you sort of have the idea of there being something that's moving from one body to another, and I don't know. That's what some translators don't use it at all. I use it sometimes. I just haven't used it tonight.
My other question is, if people have a choice of where they want to die, so they have a terminal illness, and they choose they want to go home, or they want to go to where they were born, or whatever, is that choice in other words, if they're going to be somewhere where they say, you know, they're ill in the hospital, they want to
die.
Does that influence their, must it influence the transition?
If it influences their mind state at the moment of death, then it will influence. If it makes them feel more comfortable and more relaxed, then it's going to have a positive influence. If, on the other hand, they go home and they start thinking about, I have to leave all my things, and start feeling more greed and more attachment, that's not very good either.
Maybe the hospices are
It's probably an individual thing. And when you're, you know, if you're with someone who's brought home to die, then, and you're trying to help them through the process, you can say, don't be attached to the things. Be comfortable here, but someday you're going to have to go and you can't take them with you.
And you hear often of people who are known to be in the last stages, who almost postpone. That, like, I've heard people who have, they should have died Monday morning, but they're still, they prolonged it until Wednesday.
It's not really allowing
the transition to happen.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, on a general level, it's hard to say. The basic thing is it's best to, if you're helping someone else, to try to help them have a positive state of mind. And if they put it off for an extra few days, then if they've accumulated bad karma for a few days, then they're putting off being reborn in some horrible place for a few extra days. So it's not a bad thing. There is a question over here, Coraline.
It seems like inseparable from the rational and logical obstacle to the acceptance of rebirth is one that's much more, it's rooted kind of in the heart, which is if you accept logically and otherwise rebirth, and you think about the preciousness of your birth, like the people in this room, then what you're faced with, to one of your earlier points, is that there are, for example, 70 million instances of our mothers as refugees right now. Mm-hmm. And it is, so I think what happens is that that pushes people to move backwards logically and rationally because of feelings of guilt. Which it, like,
oh, yeah.
If you love these people and you've had this bodhisattva spirit and this fearlessness and this bravery and all of that, well, then you you've got all of these instances of people who are not where you are, and that concept of guilt, though it's rooted in wrong views, it's more rooted in love, right? In this wish to not see them suffering like that.
Well, but if you understand the causes why they're suffering, why would you feel guilty? It's not something you did.
Right, but it seems like guilt and that sense of...
Yeah, guilt is a very interesting emotion. And there's no word that matches it in Tibetan. There is a word for regret, but the sort of peculiar mixture of, what is it? Sort of self-loathing and feeling inadequate and all these beating up on yourself for it. I think if you're having true... why would you have guilt if you have compassion? You try to do something to help them. What good does it do to feel bad about how they got there? You understand how they... You have to understand what made them get into a position of suffering so that you can help them. But that doesn't mean that you have to feel badly about it yourself. Now, if you did something that caused them suffering, regret what you've done, and then do something to help. That's a different method, but that's a different thing. Regret
right.
is, you know, okay, I shouldn't have done that. I'm not going to do it again.
Isn't that part of it, though, the accountability piece, the notion of collective karma, that you're working with, say, the Somali population, and you're dealing with a child who is suffering. The other side of that guilt coin is the concept of innocence, and people have a hard time looking at that example of suffering.
I had a very interesting, first a long conversation, and then an email correspondence with someone about this, and his idea is that there can be innocent people, and that because there are innocent people, then there must be suffering that happens not because of karma. But if you look, innocence can only happen if you like start from a blank slate at moment zero in this life. And if you look at it in terms of we all have an infinite succession of past lives. And we've all been born in an infinite number of places. We've done horrible things in our past lives. We've done a few wonderful things. We've obviously done some wonderful things to get to where we are. But we've also done horrible things in our past lives. And so, everyone, we've all got a mix. We're all mixed bags because we all, at this point, are obscured. That's the nature of being a sentient being. And so, it's not all that useful to worry about specifically what did they do in order to get to that action. As long as we understand the important point, at this point we can act with compassion, virtuously, and protect ourselves, and we can encourage them and other people as much as we can to act virtuously for the future, and we can try to do things to help them in their present situation. There was a question up here. Yeah, Paul.
As you said, this question about what is it, you know, if there's no inherent self, what is it that gets rebirth?
Yeah.
What is it that is passing on? The mind continuum is an easy response. I think that Tukul Damcho said it was Namche. And I was wondering...
Namche.
And I think in the book they're reading, Mahamudra, Trangu Mukherjee says that it's the aggregates, like it says here. Is that the same thing? Is it the eighth consciousness, the seventh consciousness, the aggregates? Is it... mind continuum, is that the word that you use for one of those, or is that basically saying the same thing?
In the teachings here from this Amidharma text, it primarily teaches the six consciousnesses. It doesn't really teach the seventh and eighth in that instance. You could say that it's the continuum of the eighth consciousness. That would be the, in the Mahamudra sort of tradition, that would be the way. So the continue the eighth consciousness and then the other consciousnesses that arise out of that and the appearances of a physical body that arise out of that. It's specifically the mind consciousness, the sixth mind consciousness that enters the womb at the moment of at the moment of birth. That's the specific consciousness that's operating at that moment. There may be other consciousnesses also operating at the same time. But you could say consciousness, you could say five aggregates. When the being's in the bardo, there's not much of a form, it's all mind, right? So it's four consciousnesses. And then they take take rebirth, and then they're the five consciousnesses with form. Yes?
The it's okay to ask a second question.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. Why not?
But I have a quick question about continuum, because there are a lot of words that I just assume I know what everything means about it. And I'm trying to just kind of, you know, take a look at words that I think are so easy to understand, and take another look and see if maybe there's a little bit more to it than I thought. So when I think about continuum, I'm trying to figure or think about what powers the continuum. What is the power? If you think of a river, what powers the river? And a river could be gravity, or it could be just its own momentum. And so I'm thinking about what I think is that there is that momentum in the continuum in this life and in the next life, and if that's true, is the continuum intention in the bardo as well as in this life, where in this life you could say intention or motivation to do practice and to work really hard rather than be lazy and not do anything. Is that the same thing that carries through the bardo?
Generally, when you think about analogies, you can't take them too far. Basically, when we talk about continuums, you know, it's basically, you know, like with a mala, you've got, you know, one bead after another bead. So it's like you can think of it as, you know, one moment to the next moment to the next moment to the next moment. The consciousness is the same. Mm-hmm. That's basically what we mean with a consciousness. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, with your point about continuum, it's a very important, or about intention, it's a very good point, because it's really our intentions that that it comes down to. There's a famous quote by the Buddha where he says that everything comes down to our intentions. Essentially, I don't remember exactly the words. So basically, everything rests on the point of intention. So it's really critical, because, you know, our minds are we form habits easily in our mind, and so good habit now, good moment now leads to next moment, good moment, like that.
Is there actually an energetic quality that carries forward through that power of intention?
That energetic quality would also go moment by moment by moment.
Right.
Are there any other questions, or have we overloaded you for one night? No, you've gotten a moment? Okay. Oh, yeah.
Why?
Well, because when we're born, in your next life, you might say to yourself, I want to be born as a human in my next life so I can practice Dharma. So you have that strong intention, and you manage to be born as a human in whatever. Maybe you're lucky. Maybe you're born in Argentina. If you're born in Argentina, you're human, and you'll be fed very nice steak. There is a Dharma center there, maybe two Dharma centers, in this whole country of millions and millions of people. So, will you be able to practice the Dharma? Possible, but not necessary. So when we're born in our next life, we want to make sure that we're born someplace where we can actually help practice the Dharma. And so Dewa Chen, you know, the Sukhavati is a place. You're born there, miraculous birth from a lotus, so you don't cause anyone any pain taking birth, unlike this life. And the lotus opens, you see Amitabha, he teaches you Dharma, you meditate, and then the best part is, you might think this is being selfish, but it's not. Because when you're in Dewa Chen, you're also, you know, there's a certain amount of purity that's being there. And so by having that purity of mind, you're able to send mental emanations to other realms like here, where you can help sentient beings in these other realms as well. And so it's the best of both worlds. It's like the best place to bring benefit to yourself. It's the best place to be able to actually bring benefit to other sentient beings. It's the place where you're going to be able to actually practice and attain Buddhahood. And it's easy to get to. All you need are the four causes. Just four causes. Bodhicitta, gathering merit, imagining the realm, and having, what was the fourth one? Bodhicitta. Did I say bodhicitta already?
Yes.
Oh, making the aspiration to be reborn there. And so when you recite that prayer, then you're fulfilling all four of those aspirations. So you make that prayer, and you visualize Amitabha right above your head, sitting there with his hands in meditation posture, begging bowl in his lap, red in color, ruby red. To his right is Chenrezig, who's white in color, holding two hands in with the jewel between them, the crystal mala and the lotus. And then the other side is Vajrapani, who has a vajra, also blue in color. Both of them are standing. Visualize this beautiful, beautiful place where there are people who are just practicing the Dharma. There's nothing that stops them from practicing the Dharma. Visualize that, and then make the aspiration, the real heartfelt aspiration, I really want to be born in that sort of a place. Then think about the reason to do it. It's not like, I want to be born in heaven so I can, you know, hang out with St. Peter. That's not it. It's not like that. It's a pure realm, but it's a place where you can actually bring a lot of benefits for others. And then you have to accumulate merit, too.
If you don't get your top five choices, is Maine pretty good, or... If you don't get your top five choices, is Maine pretty good?
Portland seems like a pretty hot place for the Dharma these days. Ellsworth isn't so bad either. Brunswick, they've got some Dharma going on. Maine's not so bad. Yeah.
After the 49 days, or within that time period when people are in Bardo, and then wherever their minds lead them, are they then not... they don't have any more energetic ties to their past life?
It depends on where you're reborn. Energetic ties, I don't know. That's hard to say. The Bardo isn't necessarily 49 days. Usually 49 days. Some people it lasts longer. Some people take a long time. And when you pass into your next life, sometime for birth as a human, birth is such a traumatic experience that most of us forget. A few people can remember, but most of us forget. In some rebirths, you remember what you did to get there. They say that in the hells, you remember what it is that got you into hell until such time as the suffering becomes so overwhelming that you forget everything. Yes?
How do you know that it's 49 days of that? Some people take longer.
Oh, well, there's a lot of argument about this. Some people say whenever you're ready to take birth, you take birth. Some people say if you're going to be reborn in a condition where you've got like 100 years of life, then if you spend a year in the Bardo, then you've, you know, eaten up your provisions for 1 year and you've got enough provisions left for 99 more years. There are a whole bunch of different presentations. The figure 49 comes up a lot in a lot of different scriptures. I don't have any direct evidence, but it comes up in so many scriptures we can probably say it's average. Maybe that's enough for tonight. I'd like to thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And we'll...